Anuel perked up, his round eyes growing even rounder. From the Sultan's palace?
Who told you about me? Radu asked with a puzzled smile.
Cyprian has told us all about you.
Cyprian cleared his throat.
Not all about you, just that you saved me.
Manuel nodded.
Is it true what they say about the Sultan?
Radu smiled to hide the pit that had opened up in his stomach. Had even this small boy heard that Radu was the Sultan's shameful plaything? Why would Cyprian have told him that?
They say many things. I am afraid you will have to be more specific.
That the Sultan kills a man before every meal and sprinkles his food with the blood to protect himself against death.
Radu was so relieved he had to choke back a laugh. He covered it by pretending to cough.
No, unless things have changed dramatically since I left. He prefers his food without blood, like most men.
I heard he is so wealthy that he had all his teeth replaced with jewels.
John, the older boy, said it with a studied casualness, but he leaned forward just as intensely as his brother.
That would make eating all his blood-sprinkled meals quite a task. But no, that is not true either. Though he does sometimes wear a turban so large it nearly brushes the ceiling.
That was an exaggeration, but both boys nodded in wonder.
He has fountains of clear water in all his rooms, and his fingers are so heavy with jewels that he cannot sign his own name without removing his rings first.
Manuel scowled.
I do not know why he wants our dumb city, then.
John elbowed him sharply in the side.
You are just jealous because I am the heir to the throne, and you are not.
Manuel stuck out his tongue.
Not if you die first.
Cyprian put a hand on both their shoulders.
No talk like that, boys.
They deflated, looking shamefacedly at the floor.
And I am going to have a word with your nurse about the rumours she is letting you hear.
John looked up first. He lifted his chin bravely, but it trembled slightly.
Is the Sultan as cruel as they say?
Radu wanted to deny it, but he had to remember he was playing a part.
He is. Very smart. And very focused. He will do whatever it takes to get what he wants. So yes, he can be cruel.
John nodded, then set his jaw determinedly.
Well, it does not matter. The walls will save us. And even if he gets past them, an angel will come down from heaven with flaming swords before they can pass the statue of Justinian. The infidels will never have my city.
A loud, deep laugh sounded next to them. Constantine ruffled the boy's brown curls, skewing the circlet to the side.
Your city? I am fairly certain it is still mine.
John smiled, blushing.
I only meant...
Have no fear, John. I will take good care of it until it is your turn.
They turned their smiles on Radu, the combined weight of their love and hope with the heavy gaze of Jesus above them nearly knocked Radu to the floor. He bowed to cover his feelings, then straightened.
Will you join us for a meal? Constantine asked. It will be nice to have someone else to answer their infinite questions for once.
I would love to,
Radu said, still exhausted but with a spike of excitement. This was his first personal invitation to spend time with the Emperor. It was a good thing. A step in the right direction, a way to feel like he was actually accomplishing something, even though he feared there was no point. Then a tiny hand slipped into Radu's own, and he looked down into the saintly eyes of Manuel. The little boy beamed up at him, and Radu felt his soul wilt as he smiled back. Everything had been so normal at dinner. Even Radu had managed to relax, enjoying the food and laughter and stories. All his hopes to hear something useful were dashed in the middle of bread and meat and preserved fruit. And that was when he had his idea. Mahmed might have sent him in without a plan, but he could destroy the city's chances at surviving a siege before the Ottomans ever got to Constantinople. If food made them feel normal, allowed them to continue on as though their city were not under imminent threat. The absence of food would finally make it clear they could not survive. It would be an act of mercy
destroying the food supplies. People would be forced to flee, even if it did not lead directly to surrender. At least it would empty the city of innocent citizens. Orhan, the pretend heir to the Ottoman throne, proved the key to discovering the location of one of the major food supplies. Because his men were not allowed at the wall, for fear soldiers would confuse them for Turks loyal to Mehmed, they had other assignments throughout the city, and one of those assignments was patrolling and checking all the locks on a warehouse. Radu could think of no reason for its protection other than that it housed food. It had been a simple enough task for Radu to shadow the men and find his target. But now the bigger question, how to eliminate it? Larda would burn it down. Radu did not doubt that, but the warehouse was in the middle of a relatively populated section of the city. If he set the building on fire, the fire would spread. He could end up killing innocent citizens, and part of his motivation in doing this was to save them. He could not live with collateral damage. Poison would have the same effect, because they would not know the food was poisoned until people were dead. And Radu had no real means of obtaining large quantities of poison, much less doing so in secret. He was in the kitchen tearing apart bread, pondering the problem of the food, when Nazira shrieked in terror from their bedroom. He raced upstairs to find her standing on the bed. "A rat!" She pointed to a corner where a large, mangy rat seemed equally terrified of her. "Kill it!" Radu sighed, looking for something large enough to smash the rodent. And then he stopped. A smile lit his face. "No, I am going to catch it." Though rats were in plentiful supply in the city, catching a significant number of them was no small task. Or rather, it was many, many small, wearying tasks. And because Radu could not risk being missed at the wall, he had to sacrifice sleep. Nazira loved the plan, but was physically incapable of interacting with rats without screaming. Screaming did not lend itself well to secrecy. So Radu spent all night, every night, catching rats. It was a far cry from his life at the side of the Sultan, but not so far from what his role had always been. Sneaking around, gathering supplies, building toward an ultimate goal. It would have been thrilling if it did not involve so many damned rats. "What happened to your hands?" Cyprian asked a couple of mornings into the rat adventures. He and Radu were eating together on the wall, shoulder to shoulder, as they looked out on the empty field that was filled, nonetheless, with the looming threat of the future. Radu looked down at his fingers. "Vermin, cemetery residents do not like sharing gravestones with trespassers." Cyprian set down his bread and took Radu's hands in his own. He carefully examined them. Radu's stomach fluttered. It felt like something more than fear of discovery, but he could not say what. "Be careful," Cyprian said, running a finger as soft as a whisper along Radu's palm. "We need these hands." Cyprian looked up, and Radu found himself unable to bear the intensity of his gaze. Cyprian released his hands, laughing awkwardly. "We need all the hands we can get." "Yes," Radu murmured, still feeling Cyprian's finger tracking his palm. That night, Radu had enough rats. Any more, and he would not be able to carry them in secret. He waited for Orhan's men to finish their patrol past the back doors of the warehouse. They never went inside, only checked the locks. He crept silently across the street, a wriggling, repulsive burlap sack filled to bursting slung across his back. He set the sack down and picked the lock, cursing his bitten fingers for their slowness. Cyprian had been right. They needed these hands. Finally, shivering with nerves, Radu got the door open. Slipping inside, he made his way to the center of the vast space. Crates and barrels loomed like gravestones in the darkness. Everything smelled warm and dusty. He had guessed right about the contents of the warehouse. He used the metal rod he had brought to pry open lids, then he dumped rats into crates and barrels until his sack held only the rats that had not survived captivity. But he had managed to hit barely a third of the containers. He would have to do this every night for weeks to actually destroy all the supplies.
Burn it, Lardo whispered in his mind. There's always another way, Radu answered. Thunder rumbled overhead, as though agreeing with him. The city was prone to torrential downpours. Radu would need to hurry home to avoid getting caught in one. He looked up at the ceiling, and he had another idea. Back out in the night, he examined his options. The buildings in Constantinople were old and built close together. He hurried down the alley looking for what he needed. Three buildings over, he found it. A ladder. The first drops of rain hit him as he climbed onto the building's roof. Taking a deep breath, he ran as fast as he could and jumped over the alley, slamming into the next roof so hard he nearly slid off. Lada would be so much better at this, but she also would not have bothered. Everything would already be burning. Steeling himself against thoughts of his far more capable sister, Radu ran for the next roof and sailed over the alley. Landing softly this time, he collapsed onto his back and laughed as rain pattered down around him. Beneath him, warm and dusty and dry, was the city's food. He clambered to the peak of the shallowly angled roof. The key was to pry enough shingles and thatch free to make small holes, but not so many that the damage would be noticed until it was too late. The shingles were heavy and tightly nailed down. He used his lever to pry them up. He focused on areas where it was obvious water had pooled in the many years of the roof's life. The rain began pouring in earnest. The shingles were slick. Radu clung to them carefully. He could afford neither discovery nor injury. He allowed himself a few moments of quiet triumph as he watched water stream from the sky onto the roof and through the holes he had created. Tearing up as many shingles on his way as he could, he crawled to the far end of the building. But he had a new problem. He could not run to gather momentum. With the roof this slick, he would certainly slip and fall to his death. The drop to the ground was far, three times his height, and if he crashed down with any speed, he did not like his chances. There was a narrow ledge along the edge of the roof. Rain poured around him. The storm was picking up speed and force. He left the lever on the roof and grasped the ledge. Then he lowered himself, hanging on by only his fingertips, praying silently he dropped. When he hit the ground, he collapsed, trying not to let any one part of his body absorb too much of the impact. It was a trick he had learned long ago, running and hiding from his cruel older brother, Machia. He had had to jump from many windows and walls in his childhood. Machia was dead now, and Radu did not mourn him. But as he stood checking his body for injuries, he was momentarily grateful for the lessons. One ankle was complaining and would be sore in the morning. It was a small price to pay. Radu pulled his hood up over his head.
Hey! You!
Radu turned in surprise. It was too dark for them to see his face, but Orhan's men had circled back on their patrol, and Radu was standing right next to the door of the storage warehouse. If they looked inside, all his work would be for nothing. He quickly pulled a flint from his pocket and dropped it. Then, cursing loudly in Turkish, he ran.
He was trying to burn the food! Spy! Sabotage!
The cry went up behind him, followed by the pounding of footsteps. Radu ran for his life. Bells began clanging the warning, chasing him with their peals. Radu cut through alleys and streets. He jumped over walls and kept to the darkest parts of the city. Soon he was in an abandoned area, but still he heard the sounds of pursuit. It was like a nightmare, running through a dead city, pursued in the darkness with nowhere to hide. Desperate, Radu considered the outer wall. If he could make it to the wall, he could make it outside. He could find Mahmed. But if he disappeared the same night a saboteur had been spotted in the city, it would not take much thought to connect the events. Nazira would be left in harm's way. Radu turned and ran into an empty stable. Rain poured in from the collapsed roof. He huddled in the corner of a stool. Once he had hidden with Lada in a stable. She had promised no one would kill him but her. Please, Radu thought. Please let that be prophetic. After he had waited for so long that his heart no longer pounded and he shivered with cold rather than fear, Radu stood and crept through the night. The rain was tapering off as he slowly found his way from the abandoned section of the city back to a part with life. He left his long black cloak on a washing line and combed his hair into a neat ponytail. Then he walked, unhurried, hunched against the rain. His hand was on the doorknob when someone grabbed his shoulder roughly from behind. He was spun around and embraced.
"Radu," Cyprian said, holding him tightly. "I have been looking everywhere for you. There is a saboteur in the city. They caught him trying to light a fire. I was so worried about you."
Radu took a deep breath, trying to calm his voice.
"I heard the bells and went out to see what was wrong. I feared the Ottomans had finally arrived.
But why would you worry about me?"
Cyprian lingered in the hug, then pulled back, his hands still on Radu's shoulders.
"If the Sultan's man had discovered you..."
His eyes were wrinkled with concern.
"I feared for your safety."
Radu embraced Cyprian again, both because it was warm and comforting against the weariness of this long night, and because it was the only way he could hide how touched and sad he was that Cyprian's first fear had been for Radu's traitorous life. 26. Early April. A cloud of dust hung in front of the window, where musty drapes had been hastily tugged aside. The room was in the back of the house on the second floor. Larda could see across a fallow field to the hedge where she had watched for her mother. But it was not clear enough to make out where her men waited for her. She hoped they were still waiting for her. She felt so cut off. What if they left her too? Radu was lost to her. Mahmed was a traitor. She had separated herself from Hunyadi. She could not lose her men. The maid cleared her throat. Larda expected the girl to leave, but she just stood there next to the steaming bath she had filled.
"Well?" Larda snapped.
"I will help you undress."
"No!"
The girl recoiled as if struck.
"I am supposed to."
"You are not supposed to."
"But I was to wash your hair and plait it for you after, and help you into one of her ladyship's dresses."
The girl frowned worriedly, looking at Larda's thick waist and large chest. Larda laughed, the absurdity of it all finally getting to her. Here she was, seeing her mother for the first time in 15 years, and her mother wanted to brush her hair and dress her up. No, her mother wanted someone else to do it for her. That made sense. At least Wana was not here. She would have been thrilled to volunteer.
"You may stand outside the door so that she thinks you are still in here, and then you may take a message and some food to my men outside. You will see their campfire."
The girl squeaked in fear.
"Men! I could not. It is forbidden. Oh, please, do not ask it of me. If she knew, if she found out..."
Larda held up her hands. "Very well. They will last until I go back to them. Get out!" The girl nodded, wringing her hands, and slipped out the door. Larda followed, putting her ear to the door. She could hear the rapid, panicked breaths of the girl immediately outside. What went on in this house? Larda took a bath. Over the last year on the run, she had learned never to turn down a bath or a meal. But she did not wash her hair or make any effort to tame it. She dressed again in her travelling clothes, breeches, a tunic, and a coat, all black. A red sash around her waist. When she was done putting her boots on, she opened the door. The maid was so close, their noses nearly touched.
"Your hair?"
Larda shook her head, expression grim.
"I found some of her ladyship's old dresses. I could let out the seams and..."
The girl trailed off, hope dying on her face as Larda's expression did not change.
"When is supper?"
Larda asked.
"She has already eaten."
"Without me?"
"Our schedule is very specific."
The maid leaned forward, looking to either side as though fearful of discovery.
"I will bring you some food from the kitchens later tonight," she whispered.
Larda did not know how to respond. With gratitude? Incredulity? Instead, she pushed forward with her goal. "If supper is over,
I can see her now.
Yes, she will be waiting to receive visitors in the drawing room. Does she receive many visitors?
The maid shook her head.
Almost never.
So she is only waiting to see me?
After supper, she waits to receive visitors. You are a visitor, so you may see her now.
Nada followed the girl through the hall and down the stairs.
She would much rather be facing a contingent of Bulgars.
Or a mounted cavalry. At least those she would understand. Mahmed's mother, Huma, suddenly came to mind. Huma had been ferocious and terrifying. She had wielded her very womanhood like a weapon, one Nada did not understand and could not ever use. Was that what her mother was doing, throwing Nada off guard to gain the upper hand? Huma had been able to manipulate Nada and Radu by forcing them to meet on her terms. Her mother must be doing the same thing. It was comforting, in a way, girding herself to meet a challenge like Mahmed's formidable mother. Huma was a foe worth having. A murderer many times over, who had even had Mahmed's infant half-brother drowned in a bath. Nada shuddered, the back of her hair wet against her neck. Was there a darker reason the maid had tried to insist on staying during Lada's bath? She regarded the tiny, trembling thing ahead of her with new suspicion. Flexing her hands, Nada dismissed the notion. Though Nada was certain that if her mother wanted her dead, she would make someone else do it. This waif would have to resort to poison or murdering her in her sleep. She was glad she had missed supper after all. But everything Huma had done, she had done to further her son's place in life. What would Vasilisa stand to gain by killing Nada, and why did Nada find it more comfortable to think of Vasilisa as a potential assassin lying in wait than as her mother? Before Nada could settle her mind, the maid opened a door to a sitting room. It was like being greeted by an open oven. The air was too close and heated past any reasonable degree. The windows were shuttered tightly, and a fire roared in a fireplace too large for a room this size. The maid practically tugged Nada inside, closing the door as quickly as possible behind them. It took a moment for Lada's eyes to adjust to the dim room. Her mother sat in a high-backed chair, hands folded primly in her lap, voluminous skirt hiding her feet. Her hat had been replaced with a long veil pinned at the top of her head that completely obscured her face. She was not wearing the same dress as before. This one was white, with a ruffled neck so high it looked as though her veiled head sat on a platter. All the dress's folds and pleats nearly swallowed her whole. "Oh," she said, an entire discourse in disappointment contained in that single word. "You did not change." Nada longed to draw her knives, sheathed at her wrists. "These are my clothes." She took the chair opposite her mother without being invited. It sank under her weight, the stuffing worn and the velvet threadbare.
"Would you like something? Tea? Wine?"
"Wine."
Vasilisa nodded toward the maid, who poured two glasses and handed one to each of them. Nada took a sip. Or rather, she pretended to take a sip, preferring to wait until her mother drank first. Huma was too recently on her mind to risk otherwise. So far her mother was nothing like Huma, though. Huma had filled the space around her, no matter how large the room. Even in this small room, Lada's mother seemed to blend into the furniture. Vasilisa lifted her veil and took a dainty sip. Nada followed suit. Her mother's eyes were large like hers, but there was more of Radu in her face. It was startling, seeing her brother reflected in the face of a stranger. Nada could not place the exact similarities. They had something delicate and beautiful in common. But her mother's face was worn and broken at the edges. Was that what would happen to Radu too? Would he fade with time, become a withered shadow of himself? Nada longed for Radu at her side yet again. If he were here, she could focus on protecting him. Having only herself to protect made her feel so much more vulnerable.
"Tell me," her mother said, keeping a hand in front of her mouth, "what brings you to the countryside? It is not so lovely this time of year, I'm afraid. Much nicer, once spring has taken hold.
Larda frowned. I am here to see you.
That is sweet. We do not have many visitors. She lowered her hand, smiling with tightly shut lips. Then she simply stared.
Larda wondered if her own large, hooded eyes were that disconcerting.
Larda had never been good at the games women played, the battles fought and won through incomprehensible conversations. So she pushed ahead.
I assume you have had news that my father is dead.
So is Machia. Vasilisa lifted her hand to her mouth again. Larda thought it was in horror or mourning, but Vasilisa's tone was conversational.
Do you ride? I find a brisk ride in the afternoon settles my nerves and rouses my appetite.
I have 3 horses. They have no names. I am so terrible with choosing names. But they are all gentle and sweet. Perhaps you can meet them tomorrow.
Why are you speaking to me of horses?
Larda set aside her glass and leaned forward.
You have not seen me in so many years, since you abandoned us. At least do me the courtesy of speaking to me as an equal.
Your husband, my father, is dead.
Her mother made a wounded face, a flash of truth breaking free. Her lips parted in an animal way, and Larda had a glimpse of a mouthful of broken teeth. Not rotted teeth. Larda had seen plenty of those. Nor the gaps indicating lost teeth.
Vasilisa's mouth was a graveyard of shattered teeth. Larda did not know what could have caused such damage.
Her mother, crawling away, weeping.
No, she did know what could have caused such damage. Larda lowered her voice.
He is dead.
Gone. If her mother heard her, she did not indicate it. She drew her veil back down, making a repetitive clicking noise with her tongue.
Tell me, do you hunt? I find it abominable, but I have word that all the fashionable ladies do it now.
Her laugh was high and trilling, like the panicked flight of a startled bird.
If you would like, I can have word sent to your cousin. He has an excellent falconer. I am certain he would give you a demonstration, should you wish it. He visits every summer. He has to stay in town, of course, several leagues away, but he always stops by when I receive visitors. We can expect him in a few months.
I will not be here then.
I am not here for a visit.
I need help. Vasilisa laughed again, the same terrible noise.
I should say so. But my maid works wonders on hair. We will have you settled in no time. Do you like your room?
Larda stood.
I need to speak to your father. Vasilisa shook her head. He is... He has... I believe he is dead.
With a defeated sigh, Larda sat back down.
Who leads Moldavia? Your cousin, I think.
Oh, Vasilisa wrung her hands in her lap.
Do you suppose that means he will not come this summer? I am sorry. I promised you a falcon demonstration.
I do not care about falcons. I need men. I need alliances. Larda shook, a wave of unacknowledged anger and grief overwhelming her. Her father had given her a knife, and her mother had left her with nothing. She desperately wanted something to hold on to. Or, barring that, something to fight against.
I need you to ask me where I have been the last 15 years. I need you to ask where your son is.
Her mother stood, her dress-draped frame trembling.
It is time for me to retire for the night. The maid will see to you. Your room is the nicest in the house. You will be happy, and you will be safe. This is a very safe house.
Vasilisa held out a hand. The maid rushed to her side. Larda saw for the first time that her mother walked with a pronounced limp. One of her feet, when it peeked from beneath her skirts, was twisted at an odd angle.
The way Vasilisa moved without cringing spoke of it as an old, permanent injury. Larda did not know what to say, how to talk to this strange, ruined creature. Her impression of Vasilisa on the horse had been wrong. Her mother was exactly the same person who had left them behind. The only difference was that she had found a safe place to hide. Perhaps Radu would feel tenderly toward her. Larda knew he would urge compassion. She felt only rage.
"You never came back for us," Larda said. "He sold us to the Turks. We were tortured. We were raised in a foreign land by heathens. Radu stayed behind. They broke him."
"Well," Vasilisa reached out as though she would pat Larda's arm as she passed. Her hand hovered in the air, then moved back to the maid's arm for support.
"You are welcome to stay forever. We are all safe here."
"I belong in Valahia."
Her mother's voice was as harsh as Larda had ever heard it, finally filled with true emotion.
"No one belongs there."
The maid was loath to part with any information, but as far as Larda could determine, her mother was mad. They had lived together in this house, far away from everyone and everything, for the last 10 years. Vasilisa had been given the manor by her father, who doubtless could not stand the broken shell of a woman she was. Every day was the same. The maid smiled as she described it, saying over and over how pleasant it was to be safe and to always know what to expect. This was what Larda's mother had chosen. Safety. Seclusion. The woman had abandoned her children utterly and completely to live in pampered isolation instead of dealing with the harsh realities of life. The harsh realities of her own children's desperate attempts to survive without anyone to aid them. Larda did not say goodbye. She stopped in the kitchen and stole as much food as she could carry. Then she closed the front door behind her and walked along the dark lane to where the campfire of her men, her friends, called to her. She sat next to them, drawing heat and strength from their shoulders. Bogdan shifted closer, and she leaned against him.
"Well?"
Nikolai asked.
"She is mad."
"Then you do have something in common after all."
His attempt at levity met with no reaction from Larda. His voice got quieter.
"Will there be any aid from Moldavia?"
"None that she can provide. We can go to the capital and appeal to the new king. But I do not think these people will help us. She is just like all the nobility, the boyars. They are sick with the same disease. They lock themselves in finery and wealth, and they refuse to see anything that might jeopardize their comfort."
Larda paused, remembering her mother's teeth, her mother's foot. Perhaps she should not begrudge the small measure of comfort a powerless woman had managed to find in a cruel world. But she would absolutely begrudge her mother the failure to empower herself. Running and abandoning those who needed her was the weakest, lowest thing possible. Larda would not do that. She could not. Whatever else she was, Larda was nothing like the class who could go on living after turning their backs on those who depended upon them.
"What then?" Nikolai asked. "Do we try to convince more boyars that you are a tame princess and not a warlord prince?"
Larda picked up a canteen of water and poured it on the flames, watching them sizzle and die.
"I do not know. I have tried," her voice caught. She had tried everything. She had pledged loyalty to foreign kings. She had betrayed an ally. She had trusted that love was the same as honesty.
"I have tried everything." "The little zealot was always unlikely. None of us blame you for looking for help there, though."
Larda sat up straight, alarmed.
"What do you mean?"
Nikolai's expression was without reproach.
We are all very good soldiers and scouts, Larda. Do you really think we would fail to notice the Sultan camped within miles of us?
She hung her head, the weight of her shame pulling her down. I told you I was freeing you. But when he offered help, I leapt at the opportunity.
We do not care, Petru said.
The way Bogdan sat perfectly still next to her indicated that he, perhaps, did.
We know you fight for us. For Valahia,
Nikolai shrugged.
The little zealot was a means to an end. It did not work. So, we find more means for the same end.
Larda held out her hands.
I have exhausted my means. I am sorry you have followed me this far.
We still have Hunyadi,
Bogdan said. Nikolai rubbed his beard, leaning back with a thoughtful expression.
No, Hunyadi is not our best option. We have our own Hunyadi in Larda. What we need is someone who can work new angles of power.
What we need is Matthias.
He is the same as all the other leaders, Larda said, shaking her head.
That is precisely the point, Nikolai smiled, the fire illuminating his face in the midst of the darkness.
He is the same as them. So, if we get him...
Larda took a deep breath filled with smoke. It seared her lungs. She wanted nothing to do with Matthias, and knew his help, if she could get it, would not be without a price. How much more of herself would she have to lose to get where she belonged?
For Valahia, Bogdan said.
Larda nodded.
For Valahia.
April 4th to 6th. A thick fog over the city muffled all life. Muting church bells, softening footfalls, cloaking the streets in a layer of damp and stifling mystery. Radu turned from staring out his window into the blank white that had settled over the distance like a sickness coming ever closer. Taking a deep breath, he knelt on the floor, facing Mecca. Letting go of his fear and questions, he hoped his prayer could find its way out of the fogged-in city, even if nothing else could. He was so lost in the ritual he failed to notice an increase in the frequency and number of church bells until his door burst open. For a split second, Radu froze. He was upright on his knees, so he clasped his hands in front of himself, like he had been caught in an acceptably Christian form of prayer. Cyprian, breathing hard, had been scanning the room at eye level. By the time he looked down at Radu, Radu was almost certain everything appeared as it should.
What is it? Radu asked, standing. The Turks, Cyprian steadied himself against the doorframe. They are here.
Without a word, Radu pulled on his cloak. Nazira was in the kitchen preparing the afternoon meal, with anemic vegetables and some lumpy bread.
While you are out, try to buy some meat, she called as they rushed by.
The Turks are here, Cyprian shouted.
Nazira was at their side as they ran out the front door. She wore only slippers and a layered dress. Radu unfastened his cloak and threw it around her shoulders. She held it shut, keeping pace with the two men as they raced through the streets toward the walls. If Cyprian had not been with them, Radu was certain they would have gotten lost. The fog changed the character of the city, obscuring landmarks, leaching the already faded colors. With no church steeples visible, bells rang out as though from the world of spirits, their metallic warnings hanging lonely in the air.
When did they arrive?
Radu nearly slipped on a slick portion of road. Cyprian grabbed his elbow to steady him.
I do not know. I only now heard word of it.
By the time they bypassed several religious processions and made it to the walls, Nazira was winded and Radu was exhausted. They were allowed through a postern, one of the gates between the walls that led soldiers in and out of the city. Pulled down by the weight of fear, fog had settled heavily in this no-man's land, curling and pulsing like a living thing. Radu kept brushing at his arms, trying to rub it off. They were not the only ones who had come running.
They had to wait several minutes before there was an opening for them to climb a narrow ladder to the top of the outer wall. As he searched for a good position for them, Radu bumped into Ghirsignani. The Italian nodded, shuffling to the side to let them squeeze in. There, shoulder to shoulder, were their enemies. Radu and Nazira looked out on their countrymen. Tents had sprung up out of the mist like a growth of perfectly spaced mushrooms. Movement stirred the white tendrils of fog, offering glimpses of men who were then swallowed again.
"We are beset by an army of ghosts," Cyprian whispered.
"Do not let anyone hear you say that," Ghirsignani said, his tone sharp. "We have more than enough the superstition to contend with."
"When did they arrive?" Radu asked.
He leaned forward and squinted, even though he knew it would not magically help him pierce the moisture-laden air. Knew he would not see what, who, he wanted to. But he tried nonetheless.
"It must have been in the night," Ghirsignani said. "The damn fog has been so thick, we did not even see them. I got reports of strange noises, and then it finally cleared some."
"What should we do?" Cyprian asked.
"Wait until we can see something, and then we will start collecting information."
Ghirsignani had been right. Visibility was poor, but sounds hung in the dead air. At times the noises were muted, as though coming from a very great distance, and sometimes they broke through with such startling clarity that everyone spooked, looking around in fear that the Ottomans were already behind the wall.
"Shovels," Nazira said, pointing toward the camp. "You hear that rhythmic scraping?"
Ghirsignani nodded. "They will be digging their own moat, a protective line for themselves, building up a bulwark to hide their lines behind, and generating material to try to fill in our fosse."
Another sound cut through the air. Radu had half turned before he realized what he was doing. The call to prayer, and Radu could not answer. He had prayed too early. Nazira's hand found his, gripping tightly. They stood, frozen, until it was over.
"Filthy infidels," a man to Ghirsignani's right said, spitting over the wall. "The devil's own horde."
Then the man straightened, brightening.
"You hear that, Christians? I know that liturgy. We are answering them. I..."
He stopped, his eyebrows drawing low.
"Where is it coming from?"
"Outside of the wall,"
Cyprian said, his voice as heavy and blank as the fog.
"Mercenaries?" Ghirsignani asked.
Radu realized the Italian had been addressing him.
"Probably men pressed into service from vassal states, Serbs, Bulgars, maybe even some Valachians, and then anyone who came willingly when they heard of the attack."
"Why would Christians come against us?"
The soldier's face was twisted with despair. He turned to Radu as though he held all the answers. It was Ghirsignani who spoke, though.
"For the same reason they sent us no aid. Money."
This time he spat over the wall.
"How will he organize?"
Radu leaned against the wall, turning his back on the Ottoman camps and staring toward the blank white bank of fog. Only one thing rose up high enough to pierce it, the spire of the Hagia Sophia, the cathedral the city left dark.
"Irregulars and Christians at the fronts on most areas of the wall.
Places he thinks are less important. He does not trust anyone who is here solely for money. Yanacheris and Spahi forces at the weakest points. The Lykus River and the Balhene Palace wall section.
So he will be weak where the other forces are weak. If we sallied out, broke through..."
Radu shook his head.
"He will have enough men to spare to make certain the irregulars maintain as much order and discipline as possible. There will be no breaking point in his lines. He will concentrate his attacks on your weaknesses. But he will have no weaknesses vulnerable to direct attack."
Ghirsignani sighed.
"So we wait."
"So we wait,"
Radu echoed. The next day dawned bright and clear. From the looks on the soldiers' faces, they wished it had not. Radu was once again at Ghirsignani's side, along with Cyprian. Nazira had stayed home. Her parting embrace had been too tight, her whispered caution tucked around him. Radu had to be more careful than ever. Giestinyani handed him a spyglass. He pointed toward the back of the camp, in a corner where smoke was billowing upward.
What are they doing there?
It took a moment for Radu to focus, and another few moments for him to train the glass on what he was trying to find. Familiarity warmed him, and he hid his affection behind a grim look.
Forges, he said, handing back the glass. What do they need forges that big for?
Cyprian asked.
Cannons. They're going to make cannons? On the battlefield?
Cyprian laughed.
Are they also planning on a brick kiln? Building a wall of their own while they are at it?
I think it is to repair cannons. Mostly.
They would need a tremendous amount of supplies.
Giestinyani frowned.
The logistical aspects would be a nightmare. Do you think they could actually do it?
I do. Mahmed, Radu cringed and started over. The Sultan is organized and methodical. He has resources he can pull from two continents. If he needs it, it is already here or on its way. I have been in an Ottoman siege before, under the Sultan Murat. This will be even bigger, cleaner, more efficient. Mahmed watched and learned. He will have enough supplies to last as long as he needs. The men will be limited to one meal a day to preserve food. He will keep things meticulously ordered and clean to prevent sickness.
Giestinyani pointed toward the rows of tents.
By my estimations, they are almost 200,000 men out there.
Cyprian let out a breath, as though he had been hit in the stomach.
That many?
Radu nodded.
But roughly two men in support for every one man fighting. That still leaves 60,000. 70,000.
Cyprian covered his mouth with his hand. Radu was shocked to see tears pooling in his grey eyes.
So many. What could Christianity accomplish with a mere fraction of the unity Islam has? How can our God ever withstand the ferocity of this faith?
Do not blaspheme, young man.
Giestinyani's tone was sharp, but it softened when he spoke again.
And do not despair.
The odds are not so against us as they look.
He patted the stone in front of them with one thick, calloused hand. With a handful of men and these walls, I could hold back the very forces of hell itself.
Good,
Cyprian said, his voice hollow as he looked back over the Ottoman camp.
Because it looks like we will have to.
Giestinyani left, but Radu and Cyprian stayed where they were. Cyprian waved his hand in disgust.
Look at those animals in that pen. That one there. Those are not even war animals. That lord brought those to show off.
Radu's eyes never left the red and gold tent in the center. Mahmed's.
A pasha, probably. Or a ghazi from the eastern regions. They do not see each other often, so they would want to use this as a show of wealth and strength.
Cyprian laughed.
They do not even care about scaring us. They are here to impress each other.
He sighed, finally turning and sinking down to sit with his back against the stones. Radu knew Mahmed was not here yet, that the tent was empty. Still, it was all he could do to look away and sit next to Cyprian.
If they have all that, if they can do this much on a military campaign, why do they even want our city? That camp is nicer than anything we have in here.
Radu sighed, resting his head against the cold limestone that stood between him and his people.
They think Constantinople is paved in gold. They are 200 years too late. How can the Sultan not know that?
He knows. Radu was certain of it. Mahmed was too careful, too meticulous not to know the true state of the city.
He lets them believe the city is wealthy, so they are willing to fight.
but he wants the city for itself, for its history, for its position, for his capital. And so he will take it. Radu nodded, echoing Cyprian. And so he will take it. What is life like under the Ottomans? For the vassal states and conquered people?
Radu closed his eyes and saw a red and gold tent in the darkness. Saw the face of the man who would be there so soon. Saw himself where he should have been, in the tent next to Mahmed. To impress his loyalty on Cyprian, he should probably talk of horrors. But the look of despair in Cyprian's eyes haunted him. There was comfort in the truth, so Radu extended it.
Honestly, it is better than many other things.
Radu blinked away the images of what would not be, focusing on the city on a hill in front of him.
The Ottomans do not believe in the feudal systems. People are far freer under their rule. Industry and trade flourish. They let their vassal subjects continue to worship how they wish, without persecution. They do not force conversion. Christians are free to remain Christians. The Ottomans actually prefer it, because they have to tax Muslims at a lower rate.
Cyprian laughed, surprising Radu.
Well, that is very practical of them.
Radu smiled grimly.
I do not know if it will comfort you, but when I compare the people in Valachia to the people in the Ottoman Empire, the Ottomans have it better.
Cyprian swallowed, his throat shifting with the movement. He looked down at his hands, which were clasped in front of him. But it was not better for you. Radu turned his head away, as though struck, remembering what they thought he was to Mahmed. What shame and pain they must think he carried over what he was rumored to be. What he would gladly have been, had Mahmed so much as hinted that it was a possibility.
No,
Radu said, his voice a cold shadow in the clear sunlight. He stood just in time to see Mahmed's procession arrive. The walls of the city, the least impossible barrier between Radu and his heart's desire.
Not for me.
28. Mid-April. Larda stood, paralyzed with rage and grief, next to the bed where Hunyadi lay dying. 3 weeks ago, when she left him, he had been robust and thick with power. Now he was a wasted shadow of himself. Mahmed had managed to kill him after all. Hunyadi wheezed a laugh.
He sends any men with the plague to the front lines. It is clever, really. He could not get me with a sword, but he got me with...
His words were cut off as he struggled to breathe, gasping. Larda had never before felt so powerless. She wanted to kill something. She wanted to kill Mahmed.
Where is Matthias? She asked the girl attending Hunyadi in the dark, cramped room in a humble home a good distance from the castle. The girl kept her eyes averted, tending the fire as though keeping it alive would do anyone any good.
He does not come.
His father is dying. Send someone to fetch him.
The girl shook her head, locks of hair falling in front of her face.
He will not come.
It is better,
Hunyadi said. Finally able to speak again, he smiled. His gums were pale, his lips cracked.
I was gone when my father died. Too busy fighting to watch a sick old farmer die. And now my son is too busy in the castle to watch a sick old soldier die. It is good.
Larda hated this talk. She wanted more time with Hunyadi. She wanted back the time she had squandered that had cost them both so dearly. She could still learn so much from him. She helped him sip some water, then adjusted his pillow.
How did you manage it? How did you come so far from such a humble start? I always chose the path of most resistance. Did things no one else was willing to. Took risks
no one else dared take. I was smarter, more determined, stronger.
He lifted one shaking hand in the air and wheezed a laugh.
Well, some things change. But I was always brutal. I was the most brutal. When you start lower, you have to fight for every scrap of space you occupy in the world.
He patted Larda's cheek, his palm too warm and thin like parchment.
Even starting from nothing, I had more luck than you. If you had been born a boy, the whole world would tremble before you.
Larda scowled.
I have no wish to be a man.
Then she cringed, a memory of Mahmed's hands and tongue and lips on her body. She had never been happier to be a woman than she had been in that falsely precious space. Her body had not felt like a stranger to her then. She wanted to reclaim that feeling. Hunyadi's eyes narrowed thoughtfully.
No, you are right. I think if you had been born a boy, perhaps you would have been satisfied with what the world offered you. That is how we are alike. We saw everything that was not ours, and we hungered. Do not lose that hunger. You will always have to fight for everything, even when you already have it. You will have to keep fighting to maintain it. You will have to be more ruthless, more brutal, more everything. Any weakness will undo everything you have accomplished. They will see any crack as evidence that they were right that a woman cannot do what you do.
Hunyadi knew what he spoke of. Her merits, her accomplishments, her strength would never speak for themselves. She would have to cut her way through the world, uphill for the rest of her life. She showed all her small teeth in a vicious smile.
I will make you proud. No one will be more brutal than me. No one will be more ruthless. And I will never stop fighting.
Hunyadi laughed, wheezing and gasping, until he was so pale he looked dead already. Larda helped him drink. He choked, spitting most of the water out, but managed to swallow some. Finally, he closed his eyes.
No rest for the wicked. But this wicked soul will have some now, I think. Sleep.
She wanted to give him assurances that he would get better. But she could not bring herself to lie to him. Not again.
Promise me,
he whispered.
Promise me you will watch out for my Matthias. Be his ally.
I swear it.
She did not mention that she already intended to be just that.
Your father is dying, Larda said, as she sat in a private room with Matthias. It came out as an accusation, though she knew Matthias was not to blame.
She was, at least in part.
I never understood him, Matthias said, toying with a goblet of wine. I never even really knew him. He sent me away as soon as I could talk. When he visited, he watched me with this look like he could not believe I was his. All I heard of him was stories of his conquests, his bravery, his triumphs. And when he visited, I recited poetry for him. I asked him once to teach me to fight. He had never lost his temper with me, never been around long enough to. But that day I feared he would strike me. He told me he had not fought his whole life so his son could learn to swing a sword.
Matthias touched a worn hilt at his side.
Now I have his sword, and no idea how to use it. That is his legacy to me.
You do not need a sword. All you need is to work with people who know what to do with them. Larda leaned forward, forcing him to meet her eyes.
You want to be king.
Matthias smiled slyly.
I am loyal to our blessed king. Long may he rule.
Larda brushed his false sentiment from the air with a wave of her hand.
If I wanted shit, I would have visited the privy, not asked for an audience with you. Matthias.